Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Lebanon, came to America at 18, speaking not a word of English. He graduated from Wayne State University in 1993 as the class valedictorian. At age 27, he started CIG Capital Advisors, which for the last 18 years has focused on wealth management, asset management, alternative investments, and business advisory services. A modern-day Horatio Alger story. His name, Osman Minkara. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760, WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're with a modern day Horatio Alger story, Osman Minkara. Osman, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. It's great to be here today.
Can we start by talking about growing up in Lebanon?
Of course.
And your mom and your dad, please.
Yes. So I grew up in a relatively small city, second city in Lebanon called Tripoli, to a dad who's a dentist and mom who was a very hardworking housewife, and spent the first 16 or 17 years of my life in that city all the way to high school until I decided to go to college at that point.
What's the biggest thing you learned from mom and what's the biggest thing you learned from dad?
Yes. So from that, you know, education was very important to him, and he always quoted that, you know, if I leave you with money, I'll never be sure that you guys will be okay. If I leave you with education, I'll make sure you can always make a living. And mom always installed in us hard work and excellence, and I think the combination of both really shaped our past and our future.
Osman, in high school in Lebanon, Tripoli, what kind of student were you?
Depends on who you ask. So if you look at my report card, I was a very good student because I was an A student. However, if you ask my principal, I was a troublemaker. So I was a person that really did not like playing by the rules all the time, and that had got me in trouble a few times, actually.
1988, you're 18 years old, you leave Lebanon, and you come to Detroit, Michigan. That's when everybody else was leaving Detroit, Michigan. Why did you leave Lebanon, and why did you come to Detroit?
So as you're aware, I was born and raised during the Civil War in Lebanon. So certainly that was an era where personal safety was problematic, you know, and it got to a point where my parents were not comfortable that, you know, with what's going on with the war, that it's a good place for me to be. That's number one. Number two, again, focusing on education, it was very important for me and for them that we really seek, you know, good higher education, and certainly the U.S. have the best schools in the world. Combined with the fact that my brother was doing his residency at Wayne State Medical School, you know, everybody felt that this is a good place to call home and be able to come in and do my studies.
How big was the room that he gave you?
Well, it depends how much. Without the stuff in it, it was a good size room. With all the stuff that was packed, it was kind of a relatively small room.
Okay, you come here, you're 18, you don't speak a word of English. How did you ever get by, yet alone prosper?
So I always remember, and I laugh at my first day. I arrived on Saturday evening, and my brother was actually on call, so he could not pick me up. And he sent me a friend of his, which I never met in my lifetime, with the nameplate. So he picked me up, and I went and I stayed at the brother's at the friend's house that evening. And my brother picked me up the second day on a Sunday. And on Sunday evening, Monday morning, I was scheduled to go to the English Language Institute. And on a Sunday evening, we decided that I need to figure out how to go from Farmington Hills. We lived on Orchard Lake and 13 miles down to Wayne State campus. So we got in the car. My brother drove, took the lodge down to all the way to Warren, to the Wayne State campus. And then we parked in the Wayne State campus. We exchanged seats. I got in the car, and he showed me how to drive back to Farmington Hills. And Monday morning, I was on my own because he had to go to the hospital. I was on my own driving down to Wayne State. So how did I get around? My most memorable, you know, day was that first day, because I was very proud being able to come to campus. The only problem is I never parked in a parking structure. And after I finished my classes and came back to the parking structure, it took me about 3.5 hours to find my car. And that was probably one of the most frustrating things, because you feel you're on your own, you're lost, and you don't know what to do. But quite frankly, I can give examples and examples of matters like that that I believe effectively shaped who I am today.
Early on, Osman, what surprised you the most about America?
Well, first of all, I think that culture shock is the cold weather in Detroit. That's number one. Coming from a place by the beach and having a California weather, you know, showing up in December with a light jacket, it was a shocking one. But joking aside, I think I always mention that it's a, you know, the welcoming of the people, the warm hearts of the people, even on campus. So a couple of incidents where I would stop somebody and ask them about, and I always, you know, use that example. I didn't know what, you know, Burger King is, so I used to call it King Burger. And a couple of people laughed at me, but by majority of the people, everybody was very, very helpful. Even that day where I lost my car, you know, many people volunteered to help me out. And that was great to see.
You get to Wayne State University. You graduated in 3.5 years. Class valedictorian, 3.99 GPA. So you had taken 5 classes a semester, and you also worked 30 hours a week.
Yes.
When did you sleep?
Well, I didn't have a lot of time to sleep because I still had to study, and I lived on my own for that period of time. So, again, I was determined that I needed to finish, you know, ahead of my time, and I needed to find a way to support myself. So quite frankly, I didn't have too many options. You know, when you're in that situation, you focus on getting the job done, and sleeping becomes a leisure.
Let me repeat. He comes here, he can't speak a word of English at 18. 5 years later, he graduates Wayne State University, 3.99 GPA. He's the class valedictorian. When we come back, we'll ask him, how in God's name did he ever do it? And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasul, and we're with Osman Mankura, the founder and managing principal of CIG Capital Advisors. Osman, 3.5 years, Wayne State, 3.99 GPA, class valedictorian, came there, hadn't speaking a word of English. That's impossible. How did you do it?
Well, you don't have choices. You know, if you think about it, you know, I had to come in and I had to build a future. I had to get my education and build a future. So what are the choices? Do I learn the system? Do I learn the language? Do I put myself through school and get it done? Or do I pack and go back home? And if I do, you know, what future am I building for myself at that point? So the decision was that, you know, once I'm here, it's a point of no return. And I was determined to get a couple of things done. One is to get a good education, and more importantly, use that education to be able to provide a good future that allows me to make a good living. And that was truly my focus. Now, were there some times that, you know, are very frustrating? Of course. You know, were there some times that I felt that, you know, it's time for me to really pack and go home? Many, many times I thought about that. But after a while, you wake up in the morning and say, you know, this is not a choice. The choice is you keep moving forward.
If you want to learn more about them, www.CIGCapitalAdvisors.com. All right, class valedictorian, then you get an MBA from New York University, the London School of Economics, and you get an advanced management program degree from Oxford in England, tall cotton, and you go to work for American Express Financial Advisors. Tell us about that chapter in your life.
So actually, it's interesting, Jack, because from chronology perspective, I got my MBA after American Express Financial Advisors, because that was, again, another experience in my life. Came out, got my schooling in 3.5 years, had a great experience at Wayne State, was, you know, at all times was very involved, even in leadership. I sat on the, you know, student council. I served on the board of governors of Wayne State for a period of time as a student representative. And then you realize when I graduated as a very Victorian, my goal was to go get an MBA from an Ivy League school. And I thought that no brainer, you know, I'll get in. So I put my applications in. And quite frankly, my goal was to go into corporate finance, to be a controller or CFO of a big company. And effectively, I put my applications into some of the Ivy League school. And to my shock, of the 4 or 5 I applied, I got declined on all of them. So I got reset at that point, right? Because you've got now, you're very confident of what you're able to do, and you have to go rebuild all over again. So at that point, when I joined American Express Financial Advisors, I had the idea that I'll be there for a year. I did not want to do, you know, brokerage and asset management. I wanted to do corporate finance. So maybe a good way to do it is to do 1 year at American Express and then go back and apply for my MBA. But quite frankly, life doesn't go that way. What happened is I came in into American Express and found out that this is really my passion. I couldn't be a CFO or a corporate controller. I'm more of a asset management, you know, investment banking, advisory type of a person. So when I excelled at American Express, I decided to stick it out for a few years. And I did not go back and do my MBA because I was determined that I'll go back and get my MBA from top global schools. And I realized that I had to beef up my resume in order for me to get in. So when I went back to my AMP at Oxford, that was in 1999. And at that point, I felt good because I was the youngest executive that got admitted to that program. As a matter of fact, the dean of the school, Dr. Rory Knight, called me up that day and said, "Your resume looks good. Your problem is you're too young. And this is why I'm calling you." And at the end of the call, he said, "I'm compelled. You know, you'll get your acceptance next week." And then a few years later, after in 2004, 2005, at that point, I decided to go get an executive MBA. So really the fact that I was rejected from these schools is what drove me to say, what do I need to do the next time I get to choose where I go instead of them, they choose for me which school I go into.
All right, you're 26 years old. You've had several promotions at American Express. You're actually a district manager. You've got it all. And you quit. You walk to the tune of a different drum, Rosman. So you decide to start your own financial services firm. Couple issues. You don't have any money. You don't have an office. You don't really have clients. Tell us about starting that firm.
Yeah. So there's a saying I like which says youth is wasted on the young. Because when you're young, you do things, you know, from a risk perspective that you look back at them if you're in your 40s and 50s and say, how did I do that? But sometimes things actually do work out if you're determined. So at that point, I really felt that the market, the financial services market, was shifting substantially away from the transaction brokerage of the wirehouses, and people and the baby boomers are really looking for a trusted advisor. With that being said, I felt at that point that while they're looking for a trusted advisor, they are always looking for a kind of an open architecture, you know, investment platform where they're not paying commissions, there is no conflict, and there's an alignment between what they're looking for and what the advisor is providing for them. So I saw a niche with the baby boomers of a market demand for a specific market segment, and I thought I'll go seize that. And having the entrepreneurial bug, I figured that I will do it that way. To your point, I would love to say I had a business plan, you know, that I learned from a business school. I had a budget in place. I did not. And that's not a smart thing to do, you know, looking back at it today. But one day I woke up and I said, you know, I'm going to start the firm. And you're right. I quit. I had a couple of people leave with me. And we went and we rented a hotel room at the Comfort Inn on 12 Mile and and Orchard Lake, and that was our first day of operations.
Went down the hall and made cold calls using quarters.
On payphones. You're absolutely correct. So we got a lot of quarters that day in order for us to make some calls.
And then you get successful. And you get office space. And eventually you got a staff of 12 people. Everything's going great. 10 of the people leave you. Talk about that experience.
Yeah, so before that experience, Jack, I think you talk about got an office, because it sounds, and it is, it sounds like it's a straightforward thing that you get an office, right? It wasn't for me, because I'm a 26-year-old kid, no credit, no money, really no company, and I was trying to convince a landlord to give me 2,000 square foot, right, and build it up for me, because I don't have money to build it up, and invest in that money. And I can tell you, is we've talked to a lot of landlords in town, only one accepted our proposal, and he took a risk on us. And quite frankly, I stayed with that landlord for 8 years, and a big part of not moving is the loyalty, the fact that he believed in us at a time nobody else did. And as a matter of fact, the real estate broker that got me in that 2,000 square foot space has been with us all this period of time, and any real estate we need today, we go back to him because he believed on what we're doing. So even the office space and buying furniture was not straightforward, because we got so many no's before people say, yeah, I'm willing to extend credit for you, or I'm willing to take some risk. But to your point, you're right. You know, then when we cleared that hurdle and clients start coming, you know, to us, it felt good. It felt that things are moving well. You know, finally, we're starting to get some good cash flow into the company. I start taking paycheck again, which was a nice feature. I haven't had to do that for the first couple of years. And I thought now things are stable enough that I should start a family. So I got engaged to my wife right now and lined up the honeymoon. And everything was ready to go to start a family. Financially, I felt that I'm on solid footing. And on a Friday afternoon, again, another experience in life that shapes your future. Exactly like you said, you know, had 10 employees or 10 producers, financial advisors leave the firm and effectively try to poach clients at that point. It was a very tough afternoon to stomach.
And then you had to face your mother-in-law, Gita's mom, and she was probably telling you, my daughter should have never married this guy, fell in love with this guy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, it gets better, Jack, because as a matter of fact, my mother-in-law, because my wife was living in Lebanon at that point, my mother-in-law decided that she wants to come with my fiancé to visit me at that time. So effectively, I could have really covered that stuff up, given the fact of the distance, but they decided at the same time. What happened at that point is I was awarded the Emerging Corporate Leader at Wayne State Business School. And when I told my fiancé or my wife now, Rita, that I'm getting that award, they said, we want to come in and attend it. Now, there were two issues with that, or two trying times. One, I had to obviously welcome them and be in a good mood and feel good about and get them to feel comfortable that things are stable. But more importantly, it really, you know, really still sticks in my head. I had to stand up on the podium at Wayne State Business School as an emerging corporate leader and lecture kids about what success is about. And quite frankly, at that point, my confidence was so shattered. In the back of my mind, everything I can think of is, am I really the right person to tell these kids, you know, how they should shape their future?
We're talking to Osman Mankura. When we come back, we'll ask him, why didn't he quit and go back in-house to big corporate? And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Osman Mankura, came to America at 18, not speaking a word of English. And today, one of the most successful financial planning firms in the area. 10 of the 12 leave you. Why didn't you quit?
Again, It's the same predicament you're facing to your question, why did I not go back home when things got tough? To me, I do believe you either push forward or you do a U-turn. And quite frankly, at that time, a believer for me was, if I quit this time, quitting becomes very easy. Every time there's a challenge, then you can quit accordingly. So it was really a big challenge. And what drove that belief for me was the fact that I had two or three employees that were pretty much administrative employees, an IT person, a marketing/PR, and a receptionist. And what I mean by administrative, meaning not client-facing or revenue-generating. And they came to me, and they made it clear that they don't want to lose their job, that really the income is very important for them, and they will do whatever it takes to make the firm survive. And as a matter of fact, one of them, the PR person, walked into my office and handed me a quote that I still keep on my desk right now. And the quote says, an army of sheep led by a lion always win over an army of lions led by a sheep. And in her, what she was saying to me, we are really counting on you to step up to the plate and show your determination to turn things around. So I had to make the tough decision. And quite frankly, I've been blessed over the years with a great family support. I have an older brother that is a mentor and a great supporter. And many times when I came in very distraught, you know, he always came back and says, you just can't give up. You need to keep going. And I believe you can do it. And I do believe support helps.
That quote was from Alexander the Great. I knew that because he gave me that quote ahead of time. So, all right, Osman, tell us about CIG Capital Advisors.
So we're very proud of what we've built. And when I say we, you know, we've got a great team that's been with us for a period of time, and we continue to add great talent in town. As I mentioned to you, we had an assumption that there are demand in the market of people asking for a trusted advisor, where they can ask for somebody to really give them the right advice in their financial life and help them manage their own assets they worked very hard for to ensure they meet their goals and objective. And this is nothing that we take lightly. We believe that clients come to us and they say to us, I want you to get me to my, with this complex financial world, I want you to get me to my destination, and I'm going to entrust you on my hard worked assets for you to deliver that to me. So I think this is a principle we live by, and we've said every day we remind ourselves that we want to give our client great advice, excellent performance, and more importantly, great experience, great service. And that has served us over the years. It has helped us start the firm from a planning firm to grow to become a more boutique wealth management, you know, focusing on clients that have had career success and becoming a trusted advisor for them early on in their personal life. But then that success was so prominent, and we've had good concentration in the healthcare sector, whereby these clients start saying to us, I entrust you in my personal life. Can you help me in my business life? So again, this is where you mentioned, Jack, we started business advisory because we started saying to our clients, I'll help you in your personal life, but we will have a team work with you on the business side, on your practice, on your employment contract, on your investments, on your corporate strategies, and that's what the team does. And now, again, being a trusted advisor and building the intellectual capital on the healthcare side, all of a sudden now we start building a know-how in a very specialized sector such as healthcare. We believe that we could add a lot of value becoming an active investor in new starting companies, and this is where the alternative investment came in. And today, we invest in innovative healthcare companies, and we take a great pride of that because we believe Detroit is a great city, and the fact we are able to contribute, whether on the planning or the consultancy, and more importantly, investing in up-and-coming company, it's great.
www.cigcapitaladvisors.com. Speaking of healthcare, many of your clients are physicians. Tell us about the physicians of today.
In what aspect?
Well, a lot of people, when they think of physicians, they've always trusted them. They know their world has been turned upside down with Obamacare. They also see them as lousy businessmen, independent people, and confident they have egos.
So I think clearly for the physician's clientele, and I can tell you, we can ask for better clientele. It's a great clientele. And again, we have a concentration of them. We don't have an exclusivity because, to me, it's the underpinning here for the firm. And what we provide is we provide services for people with a great, that have successful careers. But back to the healthcare providers, yes, doctors are usually very smart people. They come with a very strong technical training that aligns with their intellect. And over the years, they've been blessed with a lot of, you know, good compensation to compensate for those technical and intellect. With that being said, to your point, over the years, none of them have had the training of the economics as far as on the cost side or the revenue side. And that's shifting. And that's clearly shifting because the bills, the healthcare bills are becoming so unattainable that the whole system in the U.S. needs to adjust accordingly. So I think from a doctor's perspective, in our opinion, and this is where we advise our clients, today, in addition to becoming a very good technical and intellectual person, they really need to become a better, astute business person. They know how to manage their practice, and they understand how to manage the revenue and the expenses, which they haven't had to do that. So we do believe that there are tremendous amount of changes in the healthcare side. But quite frankly, we think these are changes that are overdue due to the cost. And more importantly, we believe that creates opportunities for our clients and for anybody that actually is involved in that sector.
Listeners listening tonight, they say, wow, this is a special young man. You still are young.
Thank you for calling me young.
Okay, you got young kids, so you got to stay young. You've got a team of 50 people. You're looking for 11 more people. But when it comes to my money, I need a financial advisor from a major house. A Merrill Lynch, a Smith Barney, a Goldman, you know. They've got all the research. Osman, you guys can't compete.
So again, if you ask the question, what do we compete on? And remember what I said. I said we provide three things that we take great pride on. Is one is we provide intellectual capital, right? High quality advice. Quite frankly, we have talent in the firm that competes with every big and small house from best schools that are fully dedicated to our clients. So yes, we do compete. I mentioned that we take care of our clients' money and we manage it for them. Again, we are steward of people's money. And quite frankly, the boutique feel and the fact we've got that connection with our clients and you're not a number gives you a much more attention, in our opinion, to where your nest egg is being taken care of. And more importantly, you know, back to this, you know, personal touch or the client relationship side, you're not a number in our firm. What you are a, you know, we have a deep relationship with you and we look at you as somebody that we're going to usher you throughout your financial goals. So my answer to you is, of course we can compete, because we can compete on the basics of service and technology and product offering, but we will shine in the intellectual capital and we will shine in the relationship side of it.
We're talking to Osman Mankura. When we come back, we'll ask him about his homeland, Lebanon. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Osman Mankura, the founder and managing principal of CIG Capital Advisors. Osman, tell us about Lebanon today.
Well, obviously, Lebanon is close to my heart. I mean, this is where I was born and raised, and before I came to the U.S. And it's a wonderful place. It used to be a wonderful place because if you look at the old days and the history, it's a place where you had tremendous amount of intellect. People are very highly educated. You had a very high level of diversity. People from different ethnic group, religious background, and different cities really coexisted in a very harmonious way. Unfortunately, that has got disrupted with the civil war, and post the civil war, all the turbulence in the country and the region. Today, Lebanon is not what, you know, it used to be, because what made the country of, you know, intellectual knowledge, good universities, highly educated people, and strong diversity has unfortunately been shifting, where the country have seen a lot of brain drain leave in order for them to seek opportunities outside. I think, you know, the political system has a lot of cracks in it, and certainly that concept of harmonious coexistence between society does not exist today. So the country has a lot of challenges. It has certainly economic challenges, no question about it, has some social challenges, and in my personal opinion, they are a governance challenge, that unless those are really taken over by some highly educated people and being able to shape the country into a better governance, better social system, and better economic system, the country will continue to be challenged as it is right now.
How special is America?
Well, it gave me my future. So you're asking a guy that's very biased, because I always, with what you just mentioned, Jack, is look what I make my living in. I make my living into providing advice and managing people's money. Everywhere else in the world, that's called banking, it's called financial services, it's called brokerage. And I've always said, if I was 26 years old, anywhere in the world, you know, that is not connected to a big family or does not have a privilege, and I came in, I said, I want a license to be able to open up financial services, right? It will never happen. It'll never happen. So it's a very special country, because it's a country that not only provided me a great education, not people welcomed me even when I did not know the language. The whole system gave me an opportunity that I have no doubt in my life that I would never get it anywhere else in the world.
Let's talk about first-generation Americans. What do they have in common? And, Osman, why are they so successful?
Drive. I think, you know, it's you always have perspective in life, right? So when I come in and if I live in Bloomfield or Farmington or Novi or wherever I live, or in Detroit, and I'm used to having a Wi-Fi and I'm used to having a very good cell phone that works and good water and great electricity and good roads, that's my perspective, right? And then it becomes a right and not a privilege. I think first generation, when they come from different type of the world, and you really realize that, you know, having electricity all the time is a privilege. We realize that having good internet connection is a privilege. All of a sudden, you get to appreciate what you have, you get to cherish it, and therefore you have a drive to keep it and build on it.
You've helped design and develop the assets necessary to build a $225 million hospital and medical center in Saudi Arabia. What's your connection to Saudi Arabia?
So the connection, I would say, to the region and not to Saudi Arabia. Clearly, if you take a look at it, we believe healthcare is global. We believe healthcare is broken all over the world. If you look at the U.S., you look at Europe, and you look at emerging markets, there are different problems in these markets, but they all have problems, right? So if you take a look at it, in the emerging market, whether the Middle East, Latin America, Asia, what you realize, you've got young population and you've got healthcare system that I don't want to generalize, but a lot of them have not very high quality. And when you look at Europe, for instance, it's a different type of set of issues. So for us, we believe if you can actually take hospitality, a Marriott, and operate globally and maintain standards, you should be able to do that in the healthcare side. So our drive is really not the drive to Saudi Arabia. Our drive is taking U.S. know-how and best practices and intellectual capital and be able to export them and transpose them to emerging markets and help these markets elevate the quality of care, at the same time give, you know, U.S. companies access to these markets. So clearly, with my knowledge of the language, my knowledge of the region, and clearly being trained, educated in the U.S., gives me an advantage to be able to work in both environment and bridge the gap. And that's the connection. So we do believe we are doing, there are great business opportunities in this emerging market, but more importantly, we are doing good. And what a better business that you are actually profitable and you do good to society.
You also are the co-chairman, board of directors of Generation One.
Yes. So as I mentioned earlier, we invest in innovative healthcare companies and technologies. And we take a great pride in that company. This company deals with, you know, mobile health. It deals with managing chronic disease. And it deals with, you know, helping patients being engaged and alter their behavior to self-manage. That's the future, Jack. As we know, we are in a future of people in consumerism in healthcare, of people managing their own care. All of us are living a lot longer. And this is a company that focuses on that. The pride we take in that, that this company, we invested in it when it was a Florida company. And when we took control over it, we made it a Michigan company. So that company is housed in Michigan. It's housed in Southfield. And we think we have a great technology that not only have application in Michigan, we think it has application nationwide and globally. And we're driving toward that.
As our time winds down this evening, what advice do you give to our young listeners?
So two things. I hope what I articulated today is Jack has been very gracious by you know, paying praises. But quite frankly, I think those are what people get to hear. A lot of time, what's truly behind those praises is many failures that people only remember the good things. And it's the failures that shapes the future, and it's not the success. So I guess my comment is there's nothing like perseverance in life, and it's very important that people have the determination to get where they need to get.
Osman Mankura, fabulous story, a modern day Horatio Alger story, and most impressively, you're giving back. Keep up the great work.
Thank you, Jack.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahom.